Hello and welcome to Additive Insight, the original additive manufacturing podcast and your source for news, interviews and comment on the latest 3D printing and additive manufacturing intelligence, brought to you by TCT Magazine. I'm your host, Sam Davis, and today I'm joined by Joe Lorienti, the founder and CEO of aerospace company Ursa Major Technologies. Lorienti founded Ursa Major as the first pure-play rocket propulsion company in the US in 2015, having previously worked on SpaceX and Blue Origin engine projects. In setting up Ursa Major, Lorienti and his team have aimed to develop technology that can allow companies to double launch capacity and solve supply chain risks at a lower cost. Through that endeavour, the company has been leveraging additive manufacturing technology, and Lorienti joins me today to share how AM enables the designs of Ursa Major's rocket engines, how the company inspects its complex components, and its focus on developing alloys for metal 3D printing. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For more additive insight, head on over to tctmagazine.com, where you can subscribe to the print edition of TCT Magazine and our weekly Additive Insight newsletter for free. Joe, welcome to the Additive Insight podcast. You founded Ursa Major in 2015, I believe, and you know the company is a manufacturer of rocket engines and expert in propulsion systems. But before we dive into all of that, can you tell us a bit about your background? From what I've read, you graduated from the University of Southern California with a degree in aerospace engineering. What happened from there to where we are today?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. That's right. I founded the company in 2015, so coming up on 9 years here. But prior to that, the entirety of my career had been in aerospace in some fashion. So in my undergrad in California, as to the extent someone could in undergrad, I did a little bit of research in fluid mechanics with a focus on propulsion. Weirdly, that was all aquatic propulsion, but we've kind of come around to more compressible environments here in aerospace. But at the time, a lot of my focus, a lot of my work was with an undergraduate student group building and launching rockets in the desert. So as we talk more about manufacturing, I think you'll see some of the background here where we, as a team of, 15 or 20 undergraduate students, had to get really creative to go build and fly rockets. So inexpensive, really clever manufacturing was probably baked in at a young age or at an early point in my career. And from there, I started at SpaceX doing propulsion manufacturing and development. So really, the heart of Ursa Major is everything from designing and bringing to market new propulsion systems to using really advanced manufacturing to field things more quickly and in a cost-effective manner. So the first Dragon capsules, the first Merlin engines, those were a massive manufacturing and development challenge that, again, kind of sparked everything we're doing here at Ursa Major. After that, I went to Blue Origin, where we were just really getting going on BE-3 development. So middle of nowhere, West Texas, the footage and photos of it have become a bit famous now with New Shepard launches, but really figuring out how do you take an engine development campaign from nothing to flight, especially human rated flight. So another kind of enormous development and manufacturing challenge. At the time, much more focused on new engine cycles, new engine architectures, and all of that kind of summed up into what we're doing here at Ursa Major, which is really bring propulsion to missions where it's needed most.
Throughout your career and working on some of those engine projects you just mentioned at SpaceX, I think you've spent some time with Blue Origin as well, or at least working with Blue Origin. Can you talk to me about, I guess, the experience you gained there and what you learned, but also the challenges you saw that maybe needed addressing and could be addressed that kind of took you in this different direction to setting up Ursa Major?
Yeah, two very different, focal points there. SpaceX really had this initial drive toward production. We knew we were going to have to build an engine a day. And that, even in the early days of the company, was a massive manufacturing challenge. It wasn't just, we need more machines, go buy a new machine shop, go stand up more heads, more capabilities. It was, how do we design the engine for methods of manufacturing that are really novel, the things that hadn't been done in the Apollo era space race. Cost is nothing, I guess, or at least we can spend a significant portion of our nation's GDP on space. So cost and drive to production were really a key to our effort at SpaceX. And then Blue Origin, we weren't quite as focused on production, at least when I was there. Now I think they are very focused on production. But again, that novel engine cycle using hydrogen for an engine, the first hydrogen human rated engine since the space shuttle main engine, meant new materials. It meant new manufacturing methods that were lower quantities, but a bit more exquisite. And so you can see where those two things together are two very, very conflicting, but very important lessons learned for a company like Ursa Major, where we might develop, in the case of Hadley, we might need dozens or hundreds of engines a year. Or in the case of some of our more exquisite defense products, you don't need dozens or hundreds a year, but hypersonics, for instance, puts engines through the worst or the most rigorous environments imaginable. And then I guess to the second part of your question, a bit of contrast that really led into Ursa Major, I guess some lessons learned, was this shift away from being a billionaire-backed company, being a company founded by an Elon Musk or a Jeff Bezos. It was really important when we founded Ursa Major that we are going to push this industry forward. We are going to sell engines early on. When we were six employees, we were working with Air Force Research Laboratory, and we were working to deliver products to customers and to meet rigorous customer requirements with, you know, 1/1000th the amount of money raised as a SpaceX or Blue Origin at the time. So it was a massive challenge, but even today, I think it really excites me to think, if we're doing our jobs correctly, we're the next step in this industry. We're taking what Elon and Jeff had done at SpaceX and Blue Origin and extrapolating that to the next step here, which is building a marketplace for aerospace.
Okay, so let's delve into that a bit more. What exactly does that involve? And I guess how early on when you set up Ursa Major, was that the aim? Was that the aim from the beginning, or is that as you kind of build out the expertise and build out the team that you realize we have the capability to now go and do this, and as you say, take that next step? How early did that kind of come into your thinking?
I love that you tied that to the team. I think that was a really big piece of it. I had seen firsthand at SpaceX and Blue Origin how difficult it was to build a team of the dozens or even hundreds of engineers required to qualify a rocket engine, to develop new manufacturing methods, to qualify new materials, in some cases, new metallic materials. So I think a big part of the original thesis was there need to be many providers of rockets, hypersonic vehicles, munitions. The talent base isn't deep enough to allow for 50 SpaceXs to emerge overnight. So this focus on propulsion, this focus on the most difficult technological aspect, should enable dozens of those to emerge without that billionaire-backed requirement. So the team was a really big piece of it. And I think in the early days of the company, we knew success meant creating more companies around us. And a big piece of that was, if you look back at the space launch, privately backed space launch industry circa 2015, when I started the company, it looks very different today. Some of those companies have unfortunately gone under. Some of those companies have still not made it to orbit, or they are just years behind their initial projections. And we are here to help them. That was always the ambition. And it's a really exciting mission to kind of rally the team around, that we are here to help other companies kind of reach their full potential.
And coming on to the Ursa Major product portfolio as it stands, there are four engine systems, the Draper, the Hadley, the Ripley, the ROA. Can you give us an overview of these different engine systems, what they've been designed for, how they, you know, help some of those companies that you were just talking about? How do they all kind of compare to each other? What, you know, what's the point of the four systems in that portfolio?
Yeah.
Obviously we could talk for ages about this, but yeah, kind of give me that overview of what they all do and how they all differ.
It's a fun time to talk about it, because it really is kind of a bit of a spectrum, or a bit of a blend between market use cases, where Hadley was our first product. It's in production today. We've got several variants of Hadley, actually, that we are deploying, flying, partnering with either government or commercial agencies on. And initially, Hadley was meant to just be a prototype. The first thought process at Earth Major was, let's go build a stage combustion engine, something deemed impossible in the US for quite a while. And we were the first oxidizer rich stage combustion engine to fire in the US, which was really exciting. And go fire it once, show everybody that we can do it, and then move on to the next product. But it turned out there was, between hypersonics and small space launch and now kind of in-space operations, there were a number of use cases for Hadley that we didn't anticipate. So we productized it very quickly. Then when we looked at which direction is the market heading, you can think Ripley is about 10 times the size of Hadley. So you start to look at larger launch vehicles, larger space launch vehicles. Airway is slightly larger, but also methane fueled as opposed to kerosene. So again, kind of a market signal, a direction that the industry was heading was methane for many engine architectures is more reusable or higher performing. For our engines, it's a bit less sensitive, but if the industry is heading that direction, it means infrastructure is heading that direction, investment is heading that direction. So we got excited to bring a new product to bear there. And then Draper is actually, it looks a lot like Hadley. If you came and saw it next to a Hadley, it almost looks like little sister of Hadley. It actually is kind of our liquid engines move into the defense space a bit more heavily. Hadley has some hypersonic use cases around test beds where you can go fly in a hypersonic environment, generate a lot of data very inexpensively. Draper takes that to the next step where you can fly on a moment's notice. It's a bit more tactical. It's a bit more responsive than a Hadley with its liquid oxygen. As opposed to cryogenic liquid oxygen, Draper uses hydrogen peroxide. Not the product that you'd find in a pharmacy, but a much more high test hydrogen peroxide. But Draper has some really exciting use cases where you can use it for, like I said, more tactical, more responsive hypersonics, but you can also use it for more tactical or responsive space launch. You can also store it on orbit without needing to worry about boil off or cryogenic conditioning. So we're seeing some really exciting, much like we did with Hadley, we're seeing some really exciting market demand for Draper on things we didn't expect. Think lunar landers, orbital transfer vehicles, tactically responsive launch where you can launch a satellite on a moment's notice. So Draper has been a really fun product to get to field here more recently.
Okay. And when it comes to the design of these various engine systems, obviously it's clear today that additive manufacturing technology is a part of your development process, but has it always been? Did Ursa Major approach these engine systems with additive manufacturing at the forefront of your minds from the beginning?
Great question. Absolutely. I mentioned Hadley. We knew from the get-go we wanted Hadley to be a staged combustion rocket engine, so an oxidizer-rich staged combustion rocket engine. By contrast, if you imagine a SpaceX Merlin, the most reliable, most prolific rocket engine in history at this point, there's an exhaust tube hanging off the side. It's just dumping fuel-rich gas because you are powering the rocket engine with a percentage of the fuel that you're carrying on the rocket, and you're just throwing it overboard. It's essentially wasted energy. A staged combustion rocket engine like Hadley, BE-4, SpaceX's Raptor, powers the rocket engine and then reuses that fuel. So it's higher performing. It's also much more complex, and the materials needed, or the hardware's environment is much more caustic. It's much more dangerous to the engine. You have typically a high temperature oxygen rich gas that just wants to corrode or burn any material in front of it. So two ways to solve that problem. You can coat your metallic alloys with a ceramic or something that can handle the oxygen, or you can use specially purposed alloys or specially designed alloys that are a bit more oxygen resistant or oxidation resistant. Those typically are expensive, or maybe they have terrible fatigue properties. Maybe they're a bit weaker. So we knew from the beginning of our company that we wanted to go into alloy development and use additive manufacturing to do so that we could iterate very quickly. We could field unique geometries. We could kind of pull people and processes and parts out of the system to really reduce that risk, reduce that complexity of a staged combustion rocket engine. So from day one, I mean, we have photos of, you know, four or five employees sitting in an attic with 3D printed metallic rocket engine parts, because we knew all of our technology was going to be based on that.
Right. And as you were kind of developing these engine systems, I guess working out where best to apply additive manufacturing technology? What did you see as the early wins there? What were the parts that immediately made sense and you were able to kind of get going right away with the technology?
I love that you ask that, because I think an early nuance that we grabbed onto and really kind of pushed all of our chips onto, if you will, is additive manufacturing should not be used for everything. If you handed me an aluminum bracket, it's almost certainly easier, less expensive, stronger to make out of sheet aluminum. You can break form it, you can stamp it. It's going to be much more effective to use other manufacturing methods. But a rocket engine is a really complex system. You have massive thermal gradients. We have parts of our engine that are, I think in Fahrenheit, so apologize to listeners that think in Celsius, but we have parts that are, you know, hundreds of degrees below zero. We have parts that are thousands of degrees above zero next to one another. And typically you'll design really unique geometries, fit ups, different metallic alloys next to one another. That's extremely easy to do in additive manufacturing. It's very difficult to do if you are buying forgings, buying castings, and building a supply chain around that. So I certainly don't attribute this saying to us. I don't know where I first heard it, but the way we think about additive manufacturing is that complexity is free. You want to use additive manufacturing where there are very complex parts, there are internal features that are difficult to manufacture any other way. And in our case, we want to use additive manufacturing where you want a bespoke alloy, where you don't want stainless steel 304. You know, even the Inconels are widely additively manufactured, but sometimes they're very difficult to go buy forgings or castings. So really, it's alloy and geometry dependent where you use additive manufacturing.
In terms of the geometry there, I wanted to talk about complexity at some point, so I may as well do so now. I went to a presentation at a conference a couple of years ago that was being delivered by Paul Gradle, an engineer at NASA. You know Paul, he's been on the podcast before as well, and he said something along the lines of that inspectability is the inverse of complexity, obviously meaning that you can produce these complex parts of AM, but inspecting them then becomes even more difficult. So in terms of inspecting the parts, that I assume that you guys inspect pretty much everything that you make and put into a rocket engine. How do you guys find that in terms of, you know, making sure that the part has been printed as it was designed to, you know, that it is the part that you want and it's the part that you know will work?
That's such a good line, by the way, inspectability and complexity. I'll have to use that with the team, but it's exactly right. And in the early days of the business, you can imagine that was a massive challenge, because we didn't have a quality lab. We didn't have quality engineers. Sending a part out for CT or X-ray was probably more costly than the part itself. So in the early days, inspection was just a massive headache that we had to take the risk of kind of combining systems level testing. So building an engine and blowing it up, or building an engine and collecting data, with inspecting those piece parts. Now we're in almost a glutton of data, which is really nice. We have, you're exactly right that geometrically we inspect 100% of the parts that come in. And that's really important to really validate consistency on the manufacturing side. So if you think about the flow of data, we have data collected while the part is being printed. We have data collected while the part is being inspected under our roof, so you can start to anchor those two together. Then we have data collected in subcomponent testing. Maybe we're flowing water through a valve, or flowing water through a part to inspect the resistance of internal channels and features. On some parts, not all parts, we'll have X-ray or CT scanning. On every build plate, on every single print, we have tensile samples. So you start to just pull all of this data together, and then you combine it with the thousands of parts that we've printed and assembled into engines and fired as an assembled engine. And you get this suite of data from a laser turning on a 3D printer to a rocket engine firing or flying. And at this point, it's been really nice to anchor our manufacturing and quality through the entire process of data collection. And I think that's been really key here, is much like any manufacturing process, you can start to batch quality inspect, but it depends on how well known the process is. I can't call one casting out of 10 good if it's the first 10 castings I've bought, but if it's castings 1000 through 1010, you probably can call one out of 10 good as long as you understand your process. So we are now far enough into 3D printing these materials, these parts, and building testing these parts that we have an understanding of the quality requirements along the way. So not 100% inspection, meaning 100% tensile, CT, fatigue, thermal, water flow, hot fire test, but we've started to batch that data together along the way.
And then coming on to alloy development, which I wasn't aware of this before coming into this conversation, but that is obviously a big part of the work you guys are doing with additive. Talk to me about, I guess, the scale of that operation, the overall goal that team is trying to meet. What are the kind of requirements that you need in the alloys you're developing that you wouldn't get, say, on the materials that are already out there available on the shelf?
Absolutely. That's been the single most exciting and kind of biggest boon to our process, as you can imagine, where oxidizer rich staged combustion engine, you know that you would like to start with an alloy that's high strength, it meets the fatigue environments that you require for whatever part in the rocket engine it is, and it can handle high temperature gaseous oxygen or a high temperature gaseous oxidizer. So in the early days of our alloy development, we focused on that entirely. It was, how do we either reach the highest temperature or the highest strength at temperature with oxidation resistance? And we have, at this point, I think three different alloys that we've worked on internally that are either different levels there or they're suited to different parts of the rocket engine. And that's been just massively successful for us. Much like just this cycle of designing, building, printing, testing many, many additively manufactured parts, having built 120, 140 Hadleys to date, we really understand oxidizer-rich stage combustion engines and alloys and geometries. And then you can start to expand that to new environments and products. So we've done alloy development around high strength alloys that are well suited to hydrogen embrittlement for liquid hydrogen rocket engines. And we've also done alloy development for high strength, low cost steels for defense systems. So that's been a really exciting kind of process for us. And that team is not massive. We have probably two or three materials experts that will tweak these alloys, tweak the 3D printing parameters, go through just a massive suite of inspections, everything from tensile to thermal tensile to environmental testing in an oxygen-rich environment, for instance. And more importantly, I think, is the team that we have that is focused on the 3D printing and kind of alloy cycling, where we can very quickly field new samples or parts or geometries with these alloys. So we have a small 3D printing facility. I always call it a center of excellence because that's really what it is. It's three employees, three engineers with three 3D printers that can move very quickly when we're developing a new part or alloy. And I think that's probably the most important piece of the process.
That's interesting. I was going to ask about the size of your kind of, you know, AM infrastructure and AM equipment. With, you know, with that small team, with that small amount of machines, how is your application of the technology evolving, would you say? What do you see as the opportunities moving forward for a company like Ursa Major, for applications like rocket engines to kind of go after? What are the next applications that you're perhaps looking to enable?
I like that question. I think what comes to mind is kind of how cyclical that can be. So in the early days of our company, it really started with how do we afford to buy 3D printers, staff a team that is either very experienced or just very passionate and creative and can learn very quickly. How do we go tweak parameters on a 3D printer? How do we, like I said, cycle through new alloys, buy powder lots that are very different and just experiment, print parts and experiment. So those were kind of the early days. In the last couple of years, the investment has gone more heavily toward the quality side. We have to ensure that we have the equipment and the team to test everything and really build a capable data set. Printing a new alloy isn't really applicable or helpful if maybe you pull one set of tensile samples and the next build plate is completely different. So that quality piece was our most recent large investment. The next phase, what we are really looking forward to, what we are really excited about, is kind of twofold. One piece is new print capabilities geometrically, so larger beds, larger platforms, and that's been worked on, that's been talked about for quite a while. So getting not just an experimental platform, but a flight capable or a qualified capable system online is going to be really key here, showing consistency across large build platforms. And then after that, is print at scale. It's driving down cost, driving up throughput. I mean, we've seen that moving from a single laser to a quad laser to many lasers in the case of some newly fielded systems. But driving down time and cost on additively manufactured hardware is kind of the next generation that we're really excited to watch, because the metallic alloy or the consumables, the inert gas, is a very small percentage of the cost of a 3D printed part. It really is the time on machine and the amortization of the machine cost.
We talk to a lot of users of additive manufacturing, and you know, they always have demands and pain points, as well as things that are working as I'd like them to work with additive manufacturing, given that it's still a technology that's developing. From Ursa Major's perspective, what would you say is great about AM technology today, and what maybe is not so great that you'd like to see get better?
Something that's great is kind of the focus on advancing the technology. We see startups, we see capable incumbents that are shipping machines around the world, investing in more data collection, more capabilities, more alloy development. That is really exciting. It tells me that we're still in the early days of additive manufacturing. I mean, 3D printing metallic parts especially is not very cost effective. You have to apply it to an industry where the cost per weight is really high. Aerospace is up there. Medical and jewelry are up there. That's why we start to see those as well. But we're seeing investments in new capabilities that will unlock bringing those costs down on a per part basis. So that's really exciting. And I give just a ton of credit to the industry for trying to create that competition, trying to create new startups, new capability sets. I think something that we have yet to look forward to, or something that's a bit painful in the industry right now, is consistency and availability. We've seen the model change a few times where the early days, it was buy a 3D printer if you want to do 3D printing. We saw a number of service bureaus pop up and really become kind of the experts, where you could treat it like a foundry. You could send design parts, they might help you design or tweak, and then they'd send you parts. And I don't know if it's the cost of capital or if it's the cost of the hardware, but that model has changed a bit. And we're starting to see this push toward next generation platforms without real clarity on where the market's headed around hardware versus machine. So I don't think it's something that the industry needs to improve on. I think it's just an area of uncertainty right now. And we're an end user. We have machines of our own. We partner with a lot of service bureaus. Seeing where that aspect of the industry starts to head over the next few years is going to be a big piece of how do you run a business like Ursa Major.
One thing I wanted to get into today, Joe, is an announcement that Ursa Major made in, I think it was November last year, which was the launch of Lynx. From my understanding, this is a process which leans on AM as well as a product agnostic tooling system. And it, you know, this Lynx approach is capable of producing scalable solid rocket motors. Can you explain in a bit more detail how this works, and I guess the impact you're expecting the Lynx approach to have?
Yes, thanks for bringing it up. So we've done product announcements in the past. We announced Arroway, we announced Draper. Lynx was a bit different. Lynx was really an announcement of a methodology that we are using to help solve just a really massive problem around the world today, which is the industrial base for solid rocket motors. We got excited about this challenge because it is perfectly suited for a company like Ursa Major. We are a propulsion company with a heavy focus or a heavy specialty on kind of flexible, scalable manufacturing because of our experience in additive. So we, about 2 years ago, first started looking at, can we field a product in the solid rocket motor line? And when we looked at the cost structure, when we looked at the engineering behind a lot of the, we'll call them current generation and next generation solid rocket motor needs, we saw a huge role for additive manufacturing. And I kind of mentioned up top, we see additive manufacturing as a way to pull people, parts, and processes out of the system. In a solid rocket motor environment, that immediately equates to safety, which immediately equates to cost. So that's been really exciting for us to use our kind of core competency in a completely new market space. And over the last couple of years, we wanted to focus on how do we field not just a single product, but similar to our space and hypersonics efforts, a methodology that is extremely flexible and can fill the needs of last generation, current generation, next generation systems that are being depleted at just massive scales today. So you touched on, we use a lot of additive manufacturing, materials development, same thing we've done on the space and hypersonic side, but we also use some really complex manufacturing design, or it's not complex, I'll just say it's novel. We use some really novel manufacturing work on the tooling side, where again, we can pull people, parts, and processes out of the system and drive down cost and drive up safety.
I think I read around the time you announced this, or perhaps it was a blog on the Ursa Major website, but there was also a kind of reshoring element or a supply chain element to, I guess, to links, but generally to what Ursa Major does. So can you talk about, I guess, the, you know, a big part of what you do, I think, is building in the United States of America, kind of at home, doing it there, you know, supporting, obviously the US has got a big space industry. So can you talk about, I guess, the challenges there and how Ursa Major is working to address that too?
Yeah, I think I'll kind of tie it across all of our product lines. But if you look at the space side initially, we started the company at a time when the U.S. was seeing startups emerge around space. SpaceX was proven and really scaling, but the U.S. didn't have a healthy space industrial base. And I would say that actually stands today. If anything, it's gotten a little bit worse. We have a monopoly on our space launch side in SpaceX. That shouldn't be the case because United Launch Alliance just launched their new rocket. It looks as though they have really next generation capability, but SpaceX is launching something like 90% of the US's orbital launches. And going back to the beginning days of our business, it was kind of the, it was this big shift from the US buying Soviet era rocket engines from Russia. You can imagine after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that's gotten even more sensitive, where Russia and Ukraine actually were proliferators of propulsion. They were selling into most of Europe, and that supply chain has been cut off. So I see a role here, not just for Ursa Major supplying the US, but Ursa Major supplying really friendly nations, allied nations everywhere on the space side of our business and on the defense side of our business. The solid rocket motor industrial base weakness wasn't really clear to us until Russia's invasion of Ukraine really accelerated depletion of a lot of those systems. And, you know, we're speaking here at the end of January. Everything going on in the Red Sea right now is really just shining more of a light on that. We're probably the biggest problem in our industrial base today is that we are using $1 to $3 million missiles to shoot down $10 to $30,000 drones. It's just a massive disparity in the economics of this technology. So the only way to kind of even that playing field is to drive down costs and drive up availability of systems that were very expensive or impossible to build in recent years. So we got really excited that across all of our platforms, propulsion is a massive need. It is the most difficult, most complex technological system. And it was kind of a forgotten art on the manufacturing side. So we can come in and help fill that gap. We can build really complex technologies in a rapid, cost-effective manner in a way that hasn't been done before.
Finally, Joe, I wanted to come on to something that I guess underpins all of the work you do, and that was another announcement made by Ursa Major late last year, which was the closing of your Series D and D1 funding rounds, where the company managed to raise $138 million. With this latest financial backing, what comes next for Ursa Major?
It's scale. It's all about deploying what we've been working on in more fields, more markets, more technologies than ever. I think we had done a really good job of building this foundation of development and manufacturing across a few different product lines. And now it's about using that footing to kind of be product agnostic. We need to apply our methodologies, our know-how, and our IP to propulsion systems everywhere. I'll even highlight markets that we're not playing in today, but this new need for drones, for high performance but low cost autonomous aerial systems is highlighting an area where the U.S. does not have an industrial base for propulsion. So Ursa Major really needs to take what we are good at, take what we have been building for 8-9 years now, and scale it and start to deploy these systems.